opportunity to welcome honorable member. I hope you had a good rest, because these coming 2 days we will be working very hard. Let me also welcome the minister and the department, the commissioners, and all the organizations that are here with us this morning. Before we can start with our meeting, our public hearings, I'm going to allow the members of the committee to introduce themselves. And then I will also then share with you who is here today to participate in these public hearings. I will start with myself. My name is Dorothy Ramudibe, the chairperson of this portfolio committee.
Morning, everyone, and compliments of the new season. My name is Per Peterson, a member in this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Grace Tseke, the member of this portfolio committee. Good morning to everyone. Everything of the best for the 2014 year. I'm Helen Lemuller, member of this committee.
Good morning and compliments. I'm Emma More, member of this committee.
Morning, I'm Sarah Paulson, member of this committee.
Good morning, everyone. Happy New Year. My name is Connie Tiemu, a member of the portfolio committee.
Thank you. Can we get the
good morning. My name is Krista Levendal. I'm a researcher through the portfolio committee.
Good morning, my name is Gary Roder and I'm the legal advisor to the committee.
Good morning, my name is Lorenzo Wexel and I'm a researcher to this committee as well.
Good morning, I'm Kashfa Ayman, the content advisor to the committee.
Morning, I'm Lely Sonobatana, I'm the committee secretary.
Thank you very much. I hope we will get to know each other as the day goes by, because we will have to say who we are when we participate in this public hearing. Do we have any apologies?
Thank you, Chair. We have received the following apologies from the members of the committee. One is from Honorable Sage, because she's got another problem. She won't be able to attend today's session. We've got also Honorable Fandar Merve. She's also attending another meeting in Gauteng. We've got Honorable Mumalo, who's still in mourning of a later session. Honorable Musimane, she is also attending the other committee that she's serving in. And the last one is from Honorable Tichetelo. She's attending a meeting in the Northwest Office. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Nelisha. Let me once more welcome everyone in this meeting and say, I think the purpose of this meeting this morning is to hear from the organizations that have made submissions. Some have made oral, are going to make oral submissions. but we have 35 organizations to present. Today we will have about, we will see where we end, because we intend going up to, we intend going up to the most 4 o'clock, but we will be guided by the inputs. South Africa has made a significant stride since the advent of democracy in enhancing gender equality and the empowerment of women. And this has been supported by the development of laws and creation of structures such as Commission of Gender Equality and the establishment of the Ministry for Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities in 2009. To this end, President Zuma has reiterated that even in this period of freedom and democracy, women's emancipation must form an integral part of the political and the socio-economic transformation program of our country. South Africa's 2010 Millennium Development Goal report indicated that the country attained the goal of universal primary education before the target date of 2015. The Inter-Parliamentary Union ranks South Africa at number 8 out of 188 national parliaments in terms of the representation of women in parliament. Notwithstanding these important achievements and commitments, more needs to be done to advance gender equality in the country. Hence, even though more girls are accessing primary, secondary, and tertiary education, there are many factors that impede women's development. A disproportionate number of women live in households which they are but are subject to poverty, fulfill multiple roles, and are adversely affected by gender-based violence, HIV/AIDS, chronic diseases, and etc. According to the 2013 Grant Thornton International Business Report, women account for 28% of senior management positions in publicly traded and private companies in South Africa, which is above the world average of 24%. The Business Women's Association of South Africa 2012 Women in Leadership Census, which looked at JSE-listed companies, their subsidiaries, and state-owned entities, revealed that the number of female dictatorships stand at 17.1%, is in line with that of the United States of America and ahead of Canada and Australia. However, BUASA's census indicated that women account for merely 3.6% of CEO positions. Overall, female board representation is still low. And as the Grant Thornton report notes, that even though the proportion of women on boards of JSE-listed companies has more than doubled in the country since 2004, women still represent less than 1 in 6 of all members. Furthermore, 21% of the South African companies surveyed have no women in senior management positions. Given many of the challenges faced by women in the country, the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities thus developed the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill in order to address the gender inequalities within the country. The purpose of the bill is to give effect to Section 9 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996, insofar as the empowerment of women and gender equality is concerned, to establish a legislative framework for the empowerment of women, to align all aspects of laws and implementation of laws relating to women empowerment and the appointment and representation of women in decision-making positions and structures, and to provide for matters connected herewith. The Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill was introduced into Parliament on the 6th of November 2013 and referred for joint taking, as well as a portfolio and Select Committee on Women, Children and People with Disabilities. It was subsequently tagged as a Section 76 bill on the 14th of November 2013 and thereafter referred to the House of Traditional Leaders on the 19th of November 2013. The mandate of the committee is underpinned by four pillars, namely oversight, legislation, international participation, and public participation. In essence, to hold the executive structures that are responsible for improving the lives of women, children, and persons with disabilities to account, vis-a-vis the Department for Women, Children, and Persons with Disability, as well as other relevant organs of state. It is also to monitor and evaluate the implementation and oversee legislation with respect to the target groups of the committee. With respect to the committee's legislative role, it is to ensure that the targeted groups are considered and prioritized in all legislation, policies, and programs. In addition to ensuring that the needs of the committee's targeted groups are mainstreamed into the core functions of government departments, organs of state, public entities, and civil society at large. To this end, the committee is mandated to create opportunities for public participation with civil society on key matters pertaining to committee's target groups, hence the public hearings on the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill that will take place this morning. The Portfolio Committee on Women, Children and People with Disability has invited interested individuals and organizations to submit written comments on the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill through the print media in December 2013. In keeping with the committee's mandate with respect to public participation, the public hearings are envisaged to provide a platform for interested persons to present to the committee their views, opinions, concerns, and recommendations with respect to the bill. The committee will, over these 2 days, listen carefully to the presentations of the public and private sector, the religious sector, non-governmental organizations, and individuals. All of the contributions are important for the committee to take heed of in its deliberations that lie ahead. Moreover, it is important to highlight that while the bill was introduced as a Section 75 bill, but was tagged by the joint tagging mechanism as a Section 76 bill, this means that the bill will go to each of the provinces where a public participation process will again be followed. It is important, therefore, to highlight that provincial legislatures would also have available role to play, and civil society would be afforded the opportunity to make additional improvements. As I conclude, once the public hearings are concluded, the Portfolio Committee would be engaging with the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities on the inputs received on the issues and compile a report, following which the National Council of Provinces led by the Select Committee on Women, Children and People with Disability will get underway with its process. And the committee welcomes all the input that are going to be presented this morning. Our proceedings will go as follows. As I indicated, that we have 35 organizations to present today and tomorrow. Each organization is going to be given 15 minutes. And the 15 minutes will include 5 minutes of questions of clarity. So we want to appeal to all of us who are here to really adhere to time so that we afford each and everyone, you know, to make a presentation. The first one on our program will be the Commission for Gender Equality. And I think it is here. Then we have Center for Constitutional Rights. Is it here? Okay. Sonke Gender Justice. SWET. Is SWET here? Okay. Community Law Center. Okay. Then we'll break for 30 minutes till, and then we'll come back and start with Center for Applied Legal Studies. Are they here? Business of Business Unit of South Africa, BUSA. Are they here? Justice Alliance of South Africa. Maybe they're still coming. Cause for Justice. Joshua Generation Church, Swaranang Legal Advocacy Center, are they here? Maybe they're coming later. Then we break for lunch, and then we'll have No Zibusiso. That's the Tebelele Foundation, is it here? Okay. Women's Legal Center. Business Women's Association of South Africa. VES Institute for Social Economic Research. Maybe they'll join us later. And if they're not here, we will then have to move those who are here up to those who are present to make their presentation. We will start with
good morning and compliments to all the members. We are looking forward to an exciting 2014, a prosperous 2014 for women in particular. I just wanted to submit an apology for the DG. She will join us later. She's presenting at the NCOP, presenting the annual report of the department. She'll come later. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. We shall then hand over to yourselves.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. It's an honor for me to, with my colleagues from CGE, to present our submission to this Honorable House. We also, from the CGE, wish everyone best compliments for 2014, a busy year for elections. So we hope that you will still give this bill time for it to go through. My colleagues are Commissioner Hicks, Commissioner Holmes, Keegan Lakay, and Mr. Disangada, who are in our office here. Just quickly to run through the introduction on our side, the presentation will be done by Commissioner Hicks. We just want to say we are very pleased that this bill is on the table. It's long overdue, and we want to put it on record. And my name is Thoko Mpumlwana. I'm the Deputy Chair of the Commission for Gender Equality. We want to say that we've worked with the department on the bill, and we've worked very well together. We continue to make our inputs, which is why we're here, to ensure that we enhance this bill. We also acknowledge the importance of this bill as an instrument of transformation and the realization of rights by women of South Africa. We want to also acknowledge that the bill entrenches constitutional values of human dignity, non-sexism, equality, and freedom. We further acknowledge that the WIGI bill addresses matters that were raised by the CEDAW committee 1988, and that South Africa has to comply and have an act that ensures that there is women empowerment and gender equality in the land. We do acknowledge that there are other pieces of legislation like the promotion, PEPUDA, employment equity, many other pieces of legislation that are lodged elsewhere, but we think that this particular one zooms into the target group, as the chairperson has said. We acknowledge that the bill is a negotiated piece of legislation and that some of its content gets watered down. However, it is important that substantive clauses that ensure gender equality and women empowerment are retained in the bill. We therefore urge that the bill be passed by this parliament, this fourth parliament, and that some of the critical issues that need enhancement be considered to ensure that its enforcement is clear. We want to call for a bill that ensures the empowerment of women economically, and we want to also even go as far as saying that we hope there will be measures put in place to ensure economic empowerment of women put in the bill. We also urge that there be clear directives on non-compliance to avoid duplication and to avoid impunity. We therefore, as the CGE, support the development of this bill. We believe that it should affect all aspects of South African society, and there should be no aspect of society, there should be no areas of our society that are not touched. Commissioner Hicks, therefore, will present the bill on our behalf. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Deputy Chair. Morning, Chairperson, Minister, and honourable members of the Legislature and colleagues in the room. I'm going to be brief, Chair, noting your request. We will make a few general observations on the bill. As Deputy Chair has highlighted, we do support the tabling of the Ouija bill before Parliament, but we feel there are certain omissions and shortcomings which need to be addressed within this committee's deliberation, so we wish to bring those to the attention of the committee. We have copies, and I believe there are extra copies if people would like one. Chair, you know well our mandate. We're obliged to advise and engage with Parliament should there be legislation tabled before Parliament that is likely to affect women and gender equality, and we accordingly formally table our submission on this bill. As Deputy Chair noted, we did collaborate with and work well with the Ministry during the development of the bill, but we do regret to note that we were not part of the development and amendments to the final version, which was tabled before Parliament, and in many respects we feel that the bill is materially different from the draft bill, and there are certain very significant clauses which have been omitted, some of which we believe should be reintroduced. When we step back and we look at what would be required in a bill on women's empowerment and gender equality, what should be the key ingredients that should step out from the bill? And our submission outlines the following general principles. As our Deputy Chair notes, we believe that a strong emphasis should be on the economy, which should be based on gender equity. We would like to see concrete, practical measures in place that accelerate women's access to the resources needed for their own economic advancement, not merely empowerment, but advancement. And we would like to see very specific and concrete measures in place that support women entrepreneurs. We believe that the unsung song, the role that women play within their communities and within their families, needs to be recognized and needs to be supported. This unpaid labor that draws on women's economic viability. But related to that, Chair, we're concerned about a conservative element, this perceived societal role of women as mothers, and we would not like to see this used as a basis for discrimination against women or a curtailing of their advancement within the community and within the workplace. We believe we need to strive for a balance between those two elements. A key element, Chair, as well, within women's empowerment and gender equality, we would like to see again within the bill, and again we believe we need to see stronger provisions in the bill that enact measures to modify the social and cultural norms and conducts which perpetuate and enable discrimination and inequality, which to our mind is the leading cause for gender-based violence in our society. So we would like to see specific measures to modify our behaviors and norms and values. and we would like to see specific measures to promote changes to these perceived roles of men and women within society, within families, in relation to women's roles and potential as leaders, their rights and their benefits. And then finally, Chair, we believe that there should be specifically enacted measures that empower women and promote gender equality. So, Chair, bearing in mind that we believe these are cornerstones for women's empowerment and gender equality, we would like to see these components strengthened within the bill. We believe that the bill in its current format does not adequately address these critical components, which we believe are fundamental to the empowerment of women. And we also believe that the constitutional framework provides us with space to be more creative in terms of promoting women's empowerment and gender equality. And as an example, Chair, we just bring to your attention some constitutional considerations. If we look at our equality clause within the Constitution, we know that the Constitution and the equality clause enable the state to put in place affirmative action or positive discrimination measures to protect or advance categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. So accordingly, Chair, we believe that the state is fully empowered and permitted by this clause to give women special treatment with regard, for instance, to their employment, access to education, housing allocation, land ownership, participation in the political life, access to resources, whether that's finance or other forms, to address the imbalances caused by patriarchy. So we would like to call upon this committee and the ministry and its engagement on the bill to take up these creative opportunities that are enabled by the Constitution to implement this affirmative action provision more broadly and strengthen and enable women's access to these measures, healthcare, land ownership, economic opportunities, etc., so that we can take full advantage of the provisions given us by the Constitution. Chair, then, with regard to general shortcomings, just an overview of some of the concerns that we would like this committee to take up in its deliberations. We believe that the bill does create in many of its clauses some uncertainty with regard to the powers of the designated minister for women, children, persons with disability in relation to the CGE that we believe bump up against our independence and powers in terms of the Constitution. And we believe that the bill presents a significant opportunity for that definition of relationship and roles between the Women's Ministry, the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities, and the Commission for Gender Equality. In some instances, Chair, the WEGI bill duplicates the mandate of the CGE as is set out in the CGE Act, and our submission speaks more concretely to that. So we would like the bill to expressly spell out that relationship and that distinction between the powers and the functions of the minister and those of the Commission for Gender Equality. We also believe that there are some operational ambiguities and some unrealistic expectations created by the bill that accord to a minister then unlimited discretion in the designation of public or private entities that would be subject to the jurisdiction of the minister. We believe that provision is overbroad and creates legal uncertainty. It may be narrowed down and refined within regulations, but for instance, technically, that designation could apply to an entity such as Parliament, it could apply to an entity such as the Commission for Gender Equality, and that needs to be made more specific. Chair, we're concerned when we look at the rights of the LGBTI sector, the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, and intersex people. We're concerned when we're talking about a bill on gender equality that specifically speaks to two genders, male and female, when we know within the sector, within the world, and South Africa should be taking the lead here. I believe as a society we've moved on in our understanding of gender and gender equality. And we need to ensure that the rights of those categories of persons are protected. Deputy Chair, you've thrown me. I'll speak a bit more to our women in the workplace. Chair, a shortcoming, and this is something we made reference to the fact that there are certain omissions from the first draft of the bill. We believe that the issue of patriarchy is not adequately addressed. And we see this play itself out in the ability of women to ascend to senior positions within traditional or religious structures, the issue of male primogeniture and women's right to inheritance, the issue of equal pay for work of equal value. Chair, the issue of patriarchy is an endemic problem within our society. It was originally addressed within the draft bill version. We're concerned at the removal of that initial clause 13.2, and we believe it should be reintroduced. Further, Chair, the bill is predominantly speaking to, in many respects, a very small percentage of women in South Africa, those who are employed and those who are participating in the public life of the country. We believe it does not adequately speak to the significant challenges to empowerment and equality that are experienced by the majority of South African women, those who are unemployed, those who are located within rural areas, those who are within vulnerable sectors of the economy, such as sex workers, for instance. And I believe when I spoke about the more creative measures that could be put in place, that that is where we would like to see those addressed. Chair, two notes on compliance and alignment with international obligations. Our submission goes through each of the articles in CEDAW. We believe that our WIGI bill should be more closely aligned to the articles set out in CEDAW, because that does provide a comprehensive framework and guideline for women's empowerment and gender equality. And we note that in terms of CEDAW, we are specifically required to address the issue of patriarchy, and certain traditional and religious practices and law perpetuate women's inequality and discrimination, and the bill does not adequately address these as Articles 3 and 16 within CEDAW spell out. Chair, the rights of rural women continue to be significantly undermined by practices of land ownership, limited access to credit, constrained opportunities in relation to their economic advancement. CEDAW Article 14 speaks to this significantly, and we believe that the bill does not address this adequately. The persistent criminalization of consensual adult sex work continues to erode the dignity, health, and labor rights of sex workers. We believe Article 6 of CEDAW requires the state to take steps to address this issue, and we believe the WIGI bill should provide such a platform. Chair, in terms of the SADC protocol, Article 2 requires states to harmonize national legislation, policy, and strategies with the regional and international instruments. We believe the WIGI bill does not live up to the requirement of Article 2 because the WIGI bill is not adequately aligned with CEDAW. We don't believe, Chair, that there's been adequate harmonization with the existing legislation that our Deputy Chair made reference to, Employment Equity PEPUDA. On the last point there, Chair, we significantly and overwhelmingly support elements of clauses 7, 9, and 10, which speak to the 50-50 targets. We believe that this is significant, it's overdue, the Constitution provides for it, the CGE endorses this as a means of substantively attaining gender equality for women's representation and political life in the workplace. Chair, then the rest of our submission speaks to very specific, and Deputy, I'll be very quick, recommendations. So in addition to the omissions and the shortcomings that our submission speaks to, Chair, we have some practical recommendations. For instance, in definitions, we need the definition on gender and equality to embrace LGBTI persons. We also believe that we should go beyond the equality, beyond using the Section 9.2 definition of equality to have a broader definition of what constitutes empowerment. Chair, the concerns in relation to Clause 6, which is around education to combat gender-based violence. It's more tweaking. We're requiring more specific allocation. There's reference to the designation of public and private entities who would be identified. We would need greater certainty over who these would be. Would this include the CGE, for instance? We're concerned then about what the constitutional implications would be in relation to the ministries authority over the CGE in this regard. We would need to have a better understanding of who the designated beneficiaries of those provisions would be. Chair, as noted, we support the reference of Clause 4 around 50-50. Chair, though, in numerous places, we note with concern that no time frames for compliance are set, which would lead to this ongoing non-compliance, and we believe that a two-year target is feasible. Chair, in relation to Clause 8, we've made recommendations that the Ministry bring in entities such as the Office of the Auditor General to assist with auditing plans and measures that are put in place. And Chair, we believe when we're looking at gender mainstreaming, we need to see the assignment of accountability to be addressed within regulations, and we need to see effective monitoring and evaluation mechanisms put in place. The practical and significant implementation of gender mainstreaming is long overdue in South Africa. Chair, Clause 9, we've made recommendations around checks and balances that address entities facing constraints such as skill shortages and operational compliance and requirements, and we're proposing, again, timeframes and guidelines that should be set out in regulation. Chair, with, in relation to Clause 10, we believe greater work and attention is required with regard to economic empowerment, as we made reference to earlier in our submission. We need to see proper benchmarking provisions in place. We need to see a tighter definition around women's empowerment. And again, the kinds of special measures, concrete measures that we would like to see put in place, we believe should be enumerated in regard to, for instance, women's access to finance, women's land rights. If not within the bill itself, then we propose within the guidelines. And then finally, the final page, Chair, with regard to clauses 11 and 12, again, we believe that greater definition and clarity is required in terms of guidelines to be established by the Minister. And again, Chair, clause 13, which speaks to collaboration between stakeholders, that word's omitted there, we believe that we support that and we believe that's necessary. But again, we believe the wording could be tightened. We need to see the nature of the relationship and the anticipated roles and obligations anticipated spelled out more clearly. And the CGE finally supports Clause 14 in its current form. So, Deputy Chair, those were the key elements of our submission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I just want to say that I think in terms of our recommendations, where we have specific amendments to clauses, I think we need to state that. And if you haven't done that, I think the committee will welcome that. You can submit that through your email to the committee. Can I afford the committee to ask for any clarity-seeking questions? Is there any Member Lamula?
Thank you, Chair. I want to support you there. That recommendations on submissions made must be clear from all parties, and it should reach us in time. Because as I now had very little time to go through these submissions last night, as I received it extremely late. Valuable submissions, extremely valuable, but time was so limited to work through all these, and what I've picked up is recommendations, clear recommendations on what is needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Let me once more thank you for your presentation. I think you actually have tried, you know, to adhere to the time, and I hope all the other owners will do that well. Thank you, Commissioner.
Our next presentation will come from the Center for Constitutional Rights Foundation. Can you come? Yeah, you have to come.
Madam Chair, good morning. Honourable Members, my name is Johan Kruger. I'm the Director for the Centre for Constitutional Rights. I'm joined by my colleague, Ms. Fefolafi Dube, who will be handling the presentation on our behalf. We recognise the Minister in the House this morning. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you. Our submission has been submitted to this committee. We don't intend dealing with everything in the submission, and we'll narrow down in the interest of time to three or four key constitutional matters, unless there's issues for clarity which we can deal with in questions. First and foremost, Honourable Chair, members, allow us to say that we support the intention of this legislation. and our submission and our critique of some of the constitutional concerns with regard to the bill must be viewed in that matter. We fully support the initiative and the objective of the bill insofar it relates to the achievement of substantive equality, insofar it relates to the achievement of constitutional values and rights and principles, and as such, the few issues that we deal with don't relate to matters pertaining to substantive gender question, but rather drafting and constitutional concern in relation to the output of the bill concerning. Handing over to my colleague, Ms. Dubey, to deal with those three or four key issues, and both of us will be with questions afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister, we thank you for this opportunity that you've afforded us to make our submissions. And as my colleague has already mentioned, we will only be dealing with pertinent aspects arising out of our submission. So we will only be dealing with three key issues, namely the application of the bill, the objectives of the bill, as well as the role of the Commission for Gender Equality. Now, as my colleague has already stated, we welcome this bill insofar as it seeks to give effect to Section 1 of the Constitution dealing with equality and non-sexism, as well as Section 9 of the Constitution, the Equality Clause. However, we felt that there were certain considerations that should be taken into that there are certain considerations which could help to strengthen the bill. Firstly, Clause 2, subsections 1, 2, and 3 make reference to the minister's ability to, from time to time, designate public or private bodies with compliance with various provisions within the bill. Now, we found this provision problematic for the reason that the criteria that will guide the minister in designating a body for compliance with these provisions is not listed. So in the event that we do not know the criteria which guides the minister, one could almost suggest that this would render the minister's actions arbitrary. And following on from this, from possibly the minister's arbitrary actions, it would mean that the bill will then not be a law of general application, but will rather be a law applicable only to those public and private bodies, which again would go against the limitation clause of Section 36 in the Constitution. Moving on to the objectives of the bill. With reference to Clause 3, the idea of a progressive realization of a minimum of 50% representation and meaningful participation of women in decision-making structures is problematic for two reasons. Firstly, with the use of the term a minimum of 50% representation, the implication with this phrase is that anything which is more than 50% would mean that men would become underrepresented, and arguably, if men are underrepresented, then they too become discriminated against, which then would go against the Equality Clause. And secondly, the Constitution seeks the achievement of substantive quality rather than democratic representation that's based on percentages, and I would refer you to Section 195, subsection 1 of the Constitution. And in fact, we have the Employment Equality Act, which is the key legislation governing equality in the workplace, which states that in seeking to ensure equality in the workplace amongst designated groups, organizations should stay away from the use of quotas and percentages. And another point concerning the objectives of the bill is the usage of the term progressive realization. The term progressive realization obviously forms a key part of the bill because it's been used at least 15 times in the bill. But the problem with using this term is that the term progressive realization merely confers a qualified right, and it does not have a qualitative interpretation. So this would need to be clearly defined in order to make the bill more succinct. Continuing with the objectives of the bill, concerning the designation of private bodies as defined in Clause 1 of the bill, this would require these private bodies, once they are designated, to address and transform societal shortcomings. And we submit that this is well beyond their scope and competency. Yes, we are aware that the Constitution in Section 8 can apply horizontally, but we still refer to Section 7 of the Constitution that states the responsibility of the state as being to respect, to promote, to protect, and to fulfill the Bill of Rights. So this designation of private bodies, in effect, can be viewed as the state abdicating on its constitutional responsibilities. In any event, it's debatable whether designated bodies can, and here I'm quoting, address the pervasive, discriminatory, patriarchal attitudes and the lingering effects of apartheid, unquote. Again, with the objectives of the bill, if one looks at Clause 7, Subsection 1, we submit that the bill is so wide that any designated body, and indeed, if we are to follow the reasoning of this wide designation, it would mean that bodies such as the Catholic Church with its male priests and a single male medical doctor practicing on his own account would be held accountable in terms of this bill, and we submit that that result would be irrational. Moving on to my third and final point, which has been belabored by my colleague, the Commissioner from Gender Equality. We submit that the gender equality, which is established in terms of the Constitution, has a constitutionally mandated obligation to promote the respect for gender equality and to promote and develop and attain gender equality as provided for in the Constitution. And the Constitution further grants powers to the Commission to monitor, investigate, research, educate, and report on issues pertaining to gender equality. However, the Act, as my colleague, the Commissioner on Gender Equality, has already pointed out, but we wish to belabor this point, the Act appears to duplicate the role of the Commission for Gender Equality, and the Act, or rather the bill as it stands, is silent on how the ministerial powers will interact with those powers of the Commission on Gender Equality. So our recommendations based on the submissions that I have made are that, firstly, in line with the constitutional value of achieving equality, the targets for laws on empowerment of women and gender equality should rather be based on broad representation of society rather than, strictly speaking, to mandatory minimum percentages. And regarding the application of the Act, the bill must provide for a criteria to be used by the minister in identifying and selecting, and indeed also excluding public and private bodies for designation in order to escape the arbitrary charge. And finally, the responsibilities that are placed upon designated private bodies need to be refined and realistic in order to avoid the irrational situations that I mentioned, where the state would effectively be abdicating its responsibility as provided for in Section 8 of the Constitution. Really, this is finally. The bill also needs to recognize and support the constitutional mandate for the Commission on Gender Equality so that parallel mechanisms are avoided and also the possibly diminishing and also possibly avoiding diminishing the functionality of the Commission. That is our submission. We thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dube. Honourable members, questions for clarity? Honourable Lamola.
My question, and I think I mentioned this right at the beginning when the presentation was done on this bill, we do have existing pieces of legislation, such as the Equality of Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, Employment Equity Act, just to name some. And I think we have five pieces that I've mentioned the last time, Basic Conditions of the Employment Act. Do you think this bill can be salvaged with amendments, or do you think the intentions or the objectives of the bill can be realized through existing pieces of legislation? And I refer to what I've mentioned here, some of them. Am I clear? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Honourable Member, yes, indeed, we make reference to that concern in our submission as well, is that this bill is silent on almost all other pieces of legislation with regard to gender equality, with regard to gender-based violence in relation to the Gender Commission. That's a big concern, and not only that it's silent on it, but it seems to be overriding all other pieces of legislation apart from the constitutional clause on the Gender Commission. As we said right at the beginning, the moral intent of this bill is sound, and we support the notion of achieving true and substantive equality on gender and non-sexism basis. However, whether this bill is the best way of achieving that is a good question. It needs substantial work to achieve what it sets out to achieve on moral high ground, and as I said, that is a noble intention. We recognize that. However, the other legislation that you refer to and that we deal with in the submission could, for the largest part thereof, be sufficient if aligned with each other. And, of course, if the Commission on Gender Equality is really empowered to be functional in the way that the Constitution envisaged it to be. 90% of the powers allocated and afforded to the Minister in terms of this bill belongs with the Commission. And in our submission, as we've made it clear in our written submission, is that the Commission, as a constitutional independent body, Chapter 9 organization, should be strengthened to do its job. Its legislation should rather be strengthened and aligned with existing legislation. So to answer your question, yes, this bill can be salvaged with quite a bit of work. There needs to be clarity on a number of the vagueness and anomalies in the bill. But I tend to think that it may be easier to work with legislation that we have in hand and rather strengthen the framework.
Thank you very much. We shall then proceed to the next presenter, which is Soki Justice. Thank you. if you are ready, you can proceed.
Good morning, Chairperson of the Committee and other honourable members and everybody else in attendance today. I'm Sherid Sanger and I'm an independent legal consultant. I will be presenting Sonke Gender Justice's submission. We have, of course, submitted a written submission. I've also just taken out some of the key comments and recommendations to talk to today. The submission is quite lengthy and there's quite a lot of detail that I've covered in it, so I've selected specific things I want to talk to. That I think are really important. But also based on some other questions raised later, if I do have a minute or two, I would like to add one or two things if I do have the time to do so. Okay. Yes, I'm going to try to get through.
including question time?
Okay. Okay, thank you, Chairperson. All right, so just to start out, I mean, I think it's important to state that we applaud the process of the bill to date. And generally, Sonke does support the general purpose and objectives of the bill. We have, however, identified several substantive and process issues with the bill that need to be addressed in order for the bill to serve its intended purpose, should it be passed into law. Finally, in the absence of some of these issues being addressed that we will raise today, we do believe that the bill may not serve a purpose in law, and or alternatively, or and slash or, that there's going to be major issues with implementation of the bill. So I'm going to try to talk to the main issues relating to what I've introduced now, in terms of us having identified problems, both substantive and process problems with the bill. The first issue I'd like to talk to is a lack of consultation. So in terms of the process followed in drafting the bill, we don't believe that it included adequate consultations with rural women, women with disabilities, and other groups of women on the margins of a society. These women are often most adversely affected by a lack of education, a lack of employment, and also poverty. And we think this is a crucial group of women that need to be consulted. They are best placed to inform the bill or what the contents of this bill should be, as it is mainly those women's needs that we need to start to address. As mentioned by the Commission for Gender Equality earlier on, the bill tends to focus on specific groups of women who may not necessarily be on the margins of society or most adversely affected by unfair discrimination and gender inequality. So the recommendation that we have is that we recommend that the committee institute or commission a process now, which will of course require the bill, the process of the bill to be stayed in a sense or to be delayed in a sense in order for these important consultations to take place. We do believe that those consultations are imperative in the interest of public participation and advancing our constitution. The other big point that I identified, and I spent quite a bit of time doing research on this, is the duplication and conflict of laws that the current bill as it stands presents, and if it is passed, the kind of conflicts that it will create. As mentioned earlier by one of the members of the committee, in terms of the Employment Equity Act 55 of 1998 and the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act 4 of 2000, there are definitely serious duplications in the bill in respect of gender mainstreaming mainly and also in relation to some strategies or approaches for women's empowerment. I acknowledge and know that this particular bill, the WEGE bill, Women's Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill, specifically calls for a quota of 50% representation of women and in terms of their participation as well, meaningful participation. This is something that I find to be quite unique. I've looked at many other pieces of legislation and couldn't find another 50% quota, which I think is important and it is something that Sonke does agree with. So that has to be acknowledged. But in terms of the other duplications, there are going to be problems. Also in relation to the powers of the Minister of Justice in terms of FEPUDA, the Equality Act, and then the Minister of Labour in terms of the Employment Equity Act, there's duplications there as well, which is, of course, problematic. And there are some things that are unique in this bill, but also in terms of other pieces of legislation, Employment Equity and FEPUDA, you will find there is also some great detail and many similarities. So the duplication is a big issue. For me, one of the most important things about the problems with this bill, actually. So in terms of our recommendations, we're saying, this, and this is something that we discussed earlier on as well in the previous presentation, we're saying that the bill needs to either amend both acts, so amend both Employment Equity Act and FEPUDA to avoid conflict between the statutes, or should not apply to women covered by the Employment Equity Act. Because the Employment Equity Act talks about designated groups, and women are one of those categories of people covered by covered by the Employment Equity Act. And this is, of course, a problem because the Ouija Bill attempts to also cover women. So when we talk about designated groups, from what it looks like to me, there's not a clear indication of who those groups would be, right? And I think that looking at the law in terms of Employment Equity Act and Bermuda covering such a wide group of women. So we know Employment Equity Act covers women in the workplace, but we also know that Bermuda covers all women that the Employment Act does not apply to. So there's a lot of clarity is needed there. The other important thing, however, we do like the provision around the measures in the for non-compliance in terms of addressing non-compliance that is set out in the Ouija Bill, and I think that it would be good for that to be extended to Bermuda, actually, because Bermuda mainly talks about going to court to do that. And what we do know about non-compliance and Bermuda is that there is a serious problem with implementation of the Act in itself. Many of the equality courts are also not being utilized in the way that they should be utilized. And that means that this bill can serve a really important purpose if it does amend the Employment Equity Act in Bermuda. There's more detail in the written submission on that point. And just to qualify, Sonke is not opposed to the bill amending these statutes on the basis that the Minister of Women, Children and People with Disabilities does have a focus of women on women, which could better serve the legal and factual advancement of women's rights because of the focus and the specialization in a sense. So we're not against that entirely. But there is another very big point that I'll try to talk to a bit later as well, very briefly. This is that we do know that the department is under-resourced, and I think under-resourced more than most other departments. And we are saying that there may not be the necessary resources to optimally enforce and implement the bill, in order for the bill to attain its objectives. And one of the major recommendations we've made in our submission is that the bill needs to be fully costed and budgeted before anything else happens. And I'll talk to this later as well. We have several amazing, really progressive pieces of legislation that are not being evenly and properly implemented. And that means that the women's lives that it attempts to improve, there is no real improvement for them. So what does that mean for this bill? Then, again, in terms of another duplication and a conflict of powers, and this was mentioned earlier by Commissioner Hicks of the Commission for Gender Equality, we do recognize that the major amendments were made from the previous version of the bill to this current one that we're now making these other submissions on, in respect of the powers of the minister. So there were very good amendments made, but we still believe that there's still some duplication, specifically in respect of monitoring, research, and education. And those three, monitoring, research, and education, falls within the ambit of the powers of the Commission for Gender Equality. And this is a huge thing, because the Commission for Gender Equality is a body created in terms of the Constitution, which is meant to be an oversight body, meant to oversee government departments and any lots of other state bodies. But the issue, or non-state bodies, but the issue is that we need to ensure that we uphold these oversight bodies because they serve a specific and a very important role in our democracy. And looking at our history of apartheid, we went these checks and balances, and oversight. So it's crucial that this issue is addressed. Our recommendation is, and we'll be saying that there should be some kind of consultation or collaboration then if this bill is passed into law. And I'm saying that, and I'm saying it in terms of knowing that several of these amendments should be effective to the bill before it would be in the position to do so. But if it is passed into law, I'm saying that there needs to be some kind of obligation on the minister to collaborate on matters with the CGE. But also, and more importantly than that, the bill needs to specifically set out areas of cooperation between the minister and the CGE. And also, it needs to clarify the exclusive jurisdiction of both the minister and the CGE. I think those are very important points. Then in terms of ensuring implementation, I spoke about that a little bit earlier, but and I just want to, this is very important to mention, like I said, there are several progressive statutes and several progressive laws and policies, including, for example, the Sexual Offences Act, which for the most part is a very good piece of legislation. There are problems with it. For the most part, it's good. And the Domestic Violence Act, which for the most part is also very good. And these acts were specifically became law in terms of addressing gender-based violence, which is one of the major manifestations of gender inequality. So we also have these problems with the implementation of this Act. At Parliament, there's been reviews into the poor implementation of the Domestic Violence Act, for example. So we're saying there are great existing frameworks, but we want to know why are they not being implemented properly and why are they not serving their purposes in the way that they should. So what we are recommending that the committee commissions or launches some kind of investigation accompanied with research into the reasons for the uneven implementation of the existing frameworks. And again, the bill must be properly costed and budgeted to ensure that it can be implemented. Otherwise, it becomes another piece of legislation which is just paper bound. Then in closing, I've just got a few more comments on education and training, and this is something which is specifically important to Songcare because one of Songcare's focuses is working with men and boys to advance gender equality. So the education and training provision in the bill, I think it is quite good, but I do think that it needs to also focus at more of a prevention focus. And part of that prevention focus should be about having programming that targets men and boys, and specifically in order to shift gender inequitable attitudes and conduct, because I think this is important that we do that and not only work with women but also with men, because we do know that the vast majority of the perpetrators of gender-based violence, for example, are men. So we need to do more prevention-based work as well. Then in terms, and this was also raised earlier by the Commission for Gender Equality, in terms of the definition section, I have not spoken to that, but I've made quite detailed comments and recommendations on the definitions. And in terms of it being quite silent on, it talks about equality for men and boys, women and girls, but it is very silent on the issue of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex persons. And this bill is very important because for this particular group of people, it needs to apply to LGBTIs on the basis that there seems to be a conceptual issue here with this bill in that it focuses on women and gender, but it doesn't see LGBTI discrimination as a form of gender discrimination, which it is, because discrimination is often experienced because of gender nonconformity. So it's important, we believe, that this bill applies to LGBTIs and extends its protections, if it's passed, of course. Lastly, the issue of intersectional discrimination. The bill omits to address intersectional discrimination, and we believe it is important that the bill does do this, because we know that they are often that in terms of explaining intersectional discrimination may be in light of multiple grounds of discrimination. So there may be discrimination experienced on the basis of gender, but that experience differs for different categories or groups of women, because it's often exacerbated by race, our socioeconomic status, our sexual orientation or gender identity. And it's crucial that the bill is able to address that compounded effect of that intersectional discrimination. And we're saying that in order to do so, our recommendation is that strategies, policies, and programs formulated to mainstream gender, it should be flexible in their approach and subject to reformulation in order to take into account the compounded effect of intersectional discrimination. Women are not a homogenous group of people, and it's important that we look at all these different factors. So, Chairperson, that's the end of the PowerPoint. I do not have any more time to talk to one more issue that I thought was important. What you allow, Chairperson?
Any questions? And if they don't have, then I can afford
you. Thank you. 1 minute. Okay, thank you. Okay. So, just a little bit about some of the definitions. I thought that in terms of the definition section, I'd like to talk about explaining what substantive equality is and what it means. We know that our Constitution and the Constitutional Court favor substantive equality. So when I talk about that, I'm talking about equality in terms of outcomes, not the formal equality, which is the other form of equality that's spoken of sometimes, which puts everybody in the same position. It doesn't look at the difference in terms of, for example, the background or history of disadvantage. So I think it's important that the bill talks to that a bit more and explains or sets out what that really means. The Constitution does it to a certain extent, but more is required in this bill, because often we use statutes as a way of adding meat, in a sense, to the Constitution, right? Because it's a duty to do that as well. So in terms of substantive equality, that needs to be clarified a bit more in the bill. And in talking about substantive equality, and I know there was a comment earlier, we know that our Constitution in Section 9 talks about the need to advance the rights of disadvantaged groups of people. We do know that women form part of that group of people. So when we talk about equality for men, boys, women, girls, and boys, we need to recognize that the bill has specific purpose of specifically advancing the rights of women who form or constitute a group of historically disadvantaged people and who continue to face high levels of disadvantage, the basis of gender. So it is very important, I think, that that is clarified. Progressive realization is another problem. Often when we talk about progressive realization, it is within the available resources. This is often problematic. We have some clauses in our constitution that has proven problematic, specifically in terms of socio-economic rights, such as rights to housing and those kinds of things. And it is important in terms of there being available money to implement it. We do know in our country that there is money, but it's often not allocated in the ways it should be. We also know we have problems with regard to fruitless and wasted expenditure and fraud and those kinds of things. So we're saying something needs to be done now, and we need that to be accompanied with the political will to do what the bill needs to do, advance women's rights and improve women's realities. The last one that I'd like to mention is specifically in terms, again, this is also around implementation. The bill talks about a code of good conduct, and codes of good conduct are about ethics and setting norms and standards. We're saying that it should not say that the minister may do so, which makes it, it doesn't create an obligation if we use the language must. Because implementation is a problem in South Africa, we are recommending that both regulations, a framework that looks at all the different laws and different roles and responsibilities of people involved in implementing that, a code of good conduct, and even national instructions if necessary, all of those need to be passed, and it must be obligation must be placed on the minister to do so within a specific period of time, which we recommend and which we think is reasonable, is 1 year, in order to ensure that implementation is the priority of the bill if it is passed. And I'm saying this again in terms of the other amendments being affected to the bill, or the bill affecting amendments to other pieces of legislation. Those are the last points I'd like to say. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stella. Right. Thank you very much for your input. Let us then proceed to Center for Law Society.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Committee, and Honourable Minister. We would like to thank you for this opportunity to present on the Women's Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill. I am Chuto Tipe, and I will be presenting with Monica D'Souza. We are both researchers at the Centre for Law and Society, which is based at the University of Cape Town. The Centre for Law and Society's core program is the Rural Women's Action Research Program. This program is based on participatory research with people based in the former homelands, in which we engage with our partners in developing knowledges that reflect power dynamics in the former homelands, and we analyze the potential impact of legislation on power relations in practice. Our submission today is based on this research, and it is informed by the experiences that women across the country in the former homelands have expressed to us. The focus of our submission today is on Clause 11, Social and Economic Empowerment in Rural Areas, which most directly speaks to our work. Our submission, in trying to respect the House's time and to keep with the time limit, our submission is principled rather than dealing with the technical drafting of the bill. We commend the objectives of the bill outlined in its opening, and the spirit in which the objectives communicate. We echo the chairperson's comments about the significant advancements that South Africa has made since the advent of democracy. We recognize also the enormous challenges that remain. In acknowledging these challenges, we would like to outline three key areas of concern that we have identified around Clause 11. Monica will begin with the first two, and I will conclude with the third.
Thank you once again for the opportunity to present our views to the committee. The first point of concern that we'd like to raise is with what we perceive as weak mechanisms for enforcing the rights that the bill is trying to protect. In terms of the bill, designated public and private bodies are required to develop and implement a broad range of plans dealing with women empowerment and gender equality. However, our concern is that the bill provides no strong mechanisms to ensure that these instruments will actually be developed, and more importantly, that they will be properly implemented. The Honourable Minister's powers seem to be generally limited to the provision of guidance once designated bodies have submitted their plans and to the discretionary review of reports on the progress that designated bodies have made. Where the designated bodies have not complied with the bill's requirements, enforcement is to be achieved through dispute resolution mechanisms. Honourable Chair, it is our submission that this is a very weak mechanism for enforcement, and this point has been echoed in other submissions that have been made to this committee too. Furthermore, even where there is compliance with the bill's provisions, there is no guarantee that once a designated body has developed and launched a certain plan, that implementation will have a trickle-down effect within that body. Taken as a whole, therefore, this framework seems at most to give the power to encourage compliance with the bill and, to a lesser extent, to encourage broad compliance with the policies that come out of the bill's provisions. Looking specifically at Clause 11, although the clause claims to trump other laws, there is no real way to compel compliance if a designated public or private body does not develop or implement the plans that it is supposed to empower women in rural areas socioeconomically. All that the clause requires is that these bodies submit plans and reports if the minister asks them to do so. If there is still non-compliance, the only remaining option is dispute resolution. In our view, Honourable Chair, these weak enforcement mechanisms undermine the potential of Clause 11 to improve the circumstances of women in rural areas. Our second point flows from this first one, and it's that our concern is that there are no concrete mechanisms for women to improve their circumstances in everyday real-life contexts in the bill. We are concerned that the bill seems to envision broad plans for empowerment and equality that are developed at top levels of designated private and public bodies to be implemented downwards. But our question is this: how will these top-level plans influence the lives of ordinary women? What women need is an intervention mechanism that can compel compliance when there are individual complaints of non-compliance with either the bill's provisions or with the actual policies that have come out of the bill. Of course, we're not saying that women should have to go to court each and every time that they experience discrimination. However, what could this bill do to improve a woman's circumstances if, for example, she was being threatened with eviction from her rural home and land by her brother, or if her access to land in practice depended on an allocation by a traditional leader? This was the experience of a woman from rural KwaZulu-Natal who spoke out in Parliament against the traditional courts bill in 2012, and there are many, many more women who could tell similar stories to her. Clause 11's impetus to develop and implement land reform plans that will ensure more land in the hands of women in rural areas, while a commendable goal, will mean little to that woman from KwaZulu-Natal if she is threatened again by her brother. Honourable Chair, it is therefore our submission that, in practice, the bill will provide no remedy for this woman's daily struggles in respect of land. I will hand over to Tutu to deal with our last point. Thank you.
We would like to echo what other submissions have said in commending the 50% requirement. We support the requirement for women's participation articulated in the 50% representation requirement. However, we believe that this requirement is not an end in itself and needs to be accompanied by other requirements that enable women's meaningful participation and recognition in different spaces. We also echo other submissions in agreeing that substantive gender equality cannot be understood without simultaneous reference to race, class, sex, and sexual orientation, amongst many others. These intersecting identities materially impact the ways that women are able to access resources, positions of influence, and formal recourse for grievances, and therefore they cannot be separated from each other. Clause 11 of the bill requires that plans be developed and implemented to, quote, ensure equal representation and meaningful participation of women in traditional councils, end quote. Although it is unclear whether equal representation means 50% of the traditional council members should be women, this sort of formal quota does not in itself alleviate discrimination faced by women who are members of these councils. Our work in the former homelands across the country has highlighted the ways that women continue to be deprived of the rights guaranteed to them in legislation and the Constitution because, as Monica has already highlighted, there is poor implementation of existing legislation and there are deeply rooted patriarchal constructions of women and femininity that limit women's life options and make them dependent on men for social and material security, and they also devalue their contributions in all spheres. Several other submissions have pointed to existing legislation that promotes many of the same ideals that the Wedgie Bill is trying to advocate, but that fail to realize these objectives because of implementation. In the context in which we are most familiar, traditional councils, there's existing legislation that requires that traditional councils be made up of one-third women. Although many traditional councils do have a third of women, this does not slow down the reports that we get from women about the intense discrimination that they face in these councils as members and in trying to access justice through these spaces. As an example, we'll again point to the 2012 Traditional Courts Bill hearings here in Parliament. Here, another woman from KwaZulu-Natal discussed how, as a member of a traditional council, she has experienced repeated violence, both social, political, and physical violence, that culminated in her having a finger amputated when she refused to stand down in the traditional council and assume the role that the senior traditional leaders and other male members of the traditional council expected her to take. This is while legislation protects her rights and requires that there be a third of women. Therefore, we argue that this is not an end in itself, and as other submissions have said, we need to look at the multiple forms of discrimination that women face and try to address these simultaneously. We conclude that while the bill was drafted with commendable intentions, we must therefore raise concerns to it as a piece of legislation that does not provide women with meaningful mechanisms through which to protect and enforce their rights. We would again like to thank the Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Committee Members and the Minister for this opportunity to present today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Honourable Members, anything to get clarity on? I think Members don't have any questions for you. Thank you very much. Let us then proceed to the next presenter, which is Sweat.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Committee on Women, Children, and People with Disabilities for giving SWET the opportunity to speak around the Women's Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill. My name is Danielle Coleman, and I'm the Human Rights and Advocacy Fellow at SWET. This presentation is in result of consultation with sex workers and our allies, and I am grateful that my team has empowered me to give this presentation. We would like to acknowledge that this bill exemplifies the government's full dedication towards eradicating gender inequality. Furthermore, we recognize the numerous efforts made by the government over the past 20 years through several pieces of legislation and the creation of the National Gender Machinery to address the disempowerment and inequality of women in South Africa. However, we would like to state that as SWET, we wholly reject this bill. Firstly, there are structural barriers that make this bill irrelevant for women in the informal sector, which include sex workers, farm workers, women in mining, and unemployed women. To name a few, Clause 4, Education and Training, Clause 7, Equal Representation and Participation, Clause 9, Measures to Empower Women and to Eliminate Discrimination, and Clause 10, Economic Empowerment. These clauses will primarily and or only benefit those women who are currently employed in the formal sector and or currently in senior positions. There are no distinct and planned out measures of implementation and no measures on how marginalized women will be incorporated. However, speaking from a sex worker's perspective, I will give a concrete example of one of those structural barriers that makes this bill irrelevant for sex workers. In South Africa, the Immorality Act of 1957 infamously criminalized sex between individuals across the color line. Later named the Sexual Offenses Act of 1957, it also prohibited brothel keeping, procuring, and living off the proceeds of prostitution. Sex workers, the sellers, were then criminalized in 1988, and clients, the buyers, in 2007. To date, this apartheid-era law, which seeks to control the sexual acts between two consenting adults, remains, which is completely inconsistent with our modern democracy. The Sexual Offenses Act of 2007 repealed most of the remaining provisions of the 1957 Act, excepting those related to prostitution. Under the Sexual Offenses Act of 2007, our clients, people working with us, and people benefiting from our work can be arrested for selling, buying, or living off of the proceeds of sex work. However, there are many issues with this law that undermine sex workers' agency and force them into oppressive, sometimes life-threatening, and unempowering situations. In a 2009 survey, 12% of sex workers reported having been raped by police, 46% threatened by police, and 28% forced into providing sexual favors. In addition, due to the stigma surrounding sex work, there's a pattern of police confiscating condoms and refusing ARVs in police cells. As one can see, the police exploit the existing power structures between the law and the criminal to force sex workers into unequal and disempowering positions. The police claim that sexual violence against sex workers is either difficult to prove or downplay their complaints. 37% of street-based and 20% of brothel-based sex workers report often experiencing violence and, alarmingly, being unable to report to the police. Because of the current law, sex workers feel unempowered to report rape, sexual assault, and violence to the police, and no matter what your profession is, no woman should feel violated in that way. This further results in triple victimization, because they are violated by the client, then they're violated by the police, and then they're violated by the law that propagates the structure. Lastly, 44 to 69% of sex workers in South Africa are infected with HIV. However, because of the stigma by health workers, only 5% of sex workers make full use of HIV services. Sex workers are disempowered as they are alienated because of their work and because of the status of their work as well. The Wedgie Bill does not address these issues, and these are the issues that sex workers are experiencing that are the most disempowering. As a result, we believe that the current law of criminalization propagates the disempowerment of sex workers and therefore is in direct violation of the intent of the Wedgie Bill. Because of the current criminal law, the structural barriers that impede sex workers' access to empowerment will still exist regardless if the Wedgie Bill is passed or not. The overall goal of the Wedgie Bill will thus ultimately be unattainable for sex workers. Furthermore, whether in its current form or an amended version, without the decriminalization of sex work, the Wedgie Bill will work as double victimization, as it will be disempowering for a large sector of women in South Africa, sex workers. Following this, I would like to address one of the main clauses within the Wedgie Bill, which again does not apply to women in the informal sector and unemployed women. Throughout pages 4 and 5 of the Wedgie Bill, one reads that there will be a progressive measures to ensure 50% representation of women in leadership and management positions across the sectors, and also meaningful participation of women in decision-making structures. This is amazing. However, our concern is that the specific provisions outlined in the bill towards achieving this goal is specifically tailored to benefit women who are already employed in the formal sector, rather public or private. This notion of 50-50 is just a matter of fairness and won't necessarily increase the market share of unemployed women or those in the informal sector. It will only benefit previously privileged women and not those who are continuously and systematically excluded from our economy. Because of particular reasons, there are some women in the informal sector who are clearly not, A, in the formal sector and perhaps have not acquired a tertiary education, which would not allow for them to actually engage with the upper mobility that the bill speaks of. More specifically on the women that we represent, in our current society, sex workers are not even seen as appropriate peoples to engage in political or economic decisions within both the public or private sectors. And therefore, as certain groups of women will be propagated and be represented, sex workers will again be alienated, and this piece of legislation will serve to be disempowering. And you know what? This is actually quite unfortunate, because even though sex workers do engage with the formal economy by providing services, paying school fees, buying products, their contribution to the economy is always ignored. Next, I would like to address the fact that we believe the Wedgie Bill is not what's needed. What is actually needed is an examination and transformation of existing laws and pending legislation. There are several bills that have literally been frozen in the halls of Parliament that would indeed address the issues outlined in the Wedgie Bill. For example, the Muslim Marriage Bill, which women have been bringing cases for the past 12 years. How about the hate crimes legislation? And since 1998, 31 lesbian women have been murdered. However, let me give you an example that directly relates to sex work. It's our dealings with the South African Law Reform Commission on the decriminalization of sex work. This is one of the issues that has been frozen in Parliament for nearly a decade. In 2001, Project 107 was established and the issue paper was released. However, there were stagnant conversations for years. Then in 2009, the discussion paper was released. However, since 2010, there has been no discussion around the discussion paper, no results on the data collected, and no further recommendations by the committee. There was no commissioners for over a year, and since they have been appointed, there have been zero meetings. There's been no final legislation decisions for over a decade on how South Africa plans to proceed in decriminalizing sex work. So while we're here currently discussing this bill that's actually relevant for sex workers are being harassed by the police. They're not being protected by violent clients. And even this Friday, an accuser will stand trial for murdering a sex worker in South Africa. Therefore, sex workers remain vulnerable with no access to justice under the law. And it's all because this legislation, decriminalization, has been frozen in Parliament. Furthermore, on this same point, based on my first point, actually, it is the current law that criminalizes sex work that is the most disempowering. And if the government would actually invest in current structures to address this issue, then as sex workers, we could discuss the relevancy of the Wedgie Bill. However, until decriminalization is seen, we cannot. Slapping on a new bill on an age-old issue is not the answer. My second to last point is addressing the development of this bill. Today, we believe that the coordination towards the development of this bill has excluded many women, including key populations. The government has consulted with a select few of NGOs and private sector agencies, directly contravening the purposes of the bill by excluding the voices and lived experiences of many women who experience on a daily life and in their daily lives disempowering situations. Furthermore, many consultations have been given by civil society themselves. Thus, we urge that for the provincial consultations, there is given adequate time for those afar to attend, that is conducted in local languages, and that there are strategic mobilization strategies by the government to ensure the women and voices of those who have been excluded, including poor women, rural women, women in the informal sector, and unemployed women, that they should also be included. My last point is that we are incredibly thankful that there have been bills and pending legislation that seek to accomplish the same issues that the Wedgie Bill outlines. However, again, we do feel that there needs to be a large-scale examination, that these need to be strengthened, that they need to be adequately budgeted for, and most importantly, that they need to be tailored to the context of the woman, which should begin with the intersecting oppressions of marginalized women. As our previous speakers have stated, women are not a homogenous group, and our bills should 100% be tailored to those intersecting oppressions. And in the interest of time, in our submission, we have already outlined our recommendations. I thank you for this presentation, and we welcome questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Coleman. Do you have any questions? Thank you so much for your input. We have heard you. Thank you. And
thank you, Chair.
We'll proceed to the next presenter, Community Law Center.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the members of the committee for the opportunity to present you today. We also wanted to note and thank you for the extension. You know, as civil society, we would still say short extension, but the extension nonetheless in terms of the submission of our written submissions to the committee. It was helpful. We do think that with more time, we could have given the committee much more rich recommendations and feedback on the bill, and I think you'll note in previous submissions and in ours the recommendations regarding that, which I'll speak to. I wanted to note that the submission that I am making was written by the Community Law Center subsequent to two national workshops that were held, one in Gauteng and one in the Western Cape, and it has been endorsed by 25 organizations and two individuals. And obviously the reason I wanted to note that is just to indicate the level of support that there is for the nature of the issues we're raising. You've started to hear them already today, and no doubt we'll continue to hear them throughout these hearings. As many of the speakers before have noted, we really do welcome broadly, and not just in this bill, the various efforts to promote the empowerment of women and to address gender inequality in South Africa. And in light of that, We support the intent of the bill. The developments over the last 20 years we recognize. I don't have time to list them. We've written them and others have mentioned them. We are of the view that, as has also been mentioned, that overall in the form that this bill is currently standing, we're not going to achieve what we need to do. We're not going to achieve the intention of the bill. We do agree with certain aspects, and I'll touch on what those are, but where we agree, We find that they tend to lack substance. Sorry. We're also concerned about key issues that are not covered in law relating to women's rights not being addressed. The issue of sex work has been mentioned. The issue of Muslim marriages is something that is languishing, not necessarily in Parliament, but languishing nonetheless. Hate crimes legislation. We're looking at issues of victim legislation, which would affect women significantly. Those things have not been moving, which may have some impact, yet this bill doesn't talk to any of those. As has been raised by previous speakers, that we see duplications in this bill, which perhaps could be better addressed through amendments to existing legislation or to attention on the implementation of those.
Very much and very strongly we believe the analysis and responses to the drivers of women's inequality and discrimination of women is very poor in this bill. And then finally, we feel that except as it deals with equality in employment, as has been discussed previously, the bill fails to address the implementation of a wealth of existing laws. So as it stands, we feel this bill doesn't speak to what the needs are of the majority of women in the country, and that we're going to need to do much more than this bill. I think everyone in this room is very familiar with the situation of women in South Africa, and I wanted to thank my colleagues from the Center for Law and Society who used, in relation to their submission, some examples of how discrimination persists. I think it's important to talk beyond just saying women are still living in very, very dangerous conditions. Discrimination against women is extremely rife and prevalent. And those of us in the sector who met and have been talking over the last number of years are highly concerned that in spite of the significant developments in the legal framework, in the policy arena, and in other ways, both and largely by government, but also with civil society, we're not seeing changes. So we heard mentioned via the Sonke Gender Justice submission of sexual offences legislation and domestic violence legislation. Why is it that the conviction rates haven't significantly changed? Why is it that women still go to police stations and are turned away or their rights are violated, they may be further harmed? Why is very good law not being implemented? So that really is the big question. And we see it in a number of areas, not just in those that I've raised. As has been noted, and I wanted to also support those submissions, the issue of intersectionality with other forms of discrimination has to be addressed better than is currently the case. As was just said, women are not a homogenous group. Different women have different experiences. And if we don't tailor our responses to address the particular marginalizations of different groups, they will continue to be marginalized. And our changes will continue to only serve those already who already have some kind of basis, perhaps it's economic or other social standing. In terms of my suggestion that we think the analysis on which the bill is based is weak, the biggest issue is that of patriarchy. It was raised in the CGE submission. This is at the core of the deep inequality and disempowerment of women in South Africa across settings. It's certainly part of why we're not seeing change in the existing laws, because although the paper says you must do something different, you're still actually not worth anything more, whether it's our time or being listened to and so on. But beyond the implementation of laws, it's also fueling all the discrimination and the violations across settings. So as was noted, South Africa's not meeting its international obligations in terms of CEDAW, in terms of the Maputo Protocol, in terms of the SADC Declaration on Gender. We don't see national programs, government-led, in place to address this very complex issue. This bill is very weak. My submission does note where the word patriarchy is referenced and also another section which it could be seen to fit into. But this bill doesn't address this in any meaningful way and certainly doesn't address it in terms of programs. And I wanted to also note that in addition to this bill, we'll need a lot more, as with our other experiences. Putting references to patriarchy and even trying to build some responses to patriarchy into the law isn't going to amount to programs that address it. Most importantly, I've bolded this point, we need leadership. We need leadership from government on this, and there are significant concerns about the level of understanding of patriarchy within our leadership in this country, the kinds of statements that are routinely made and reported on in the press that fuel the widespread misogyny that exists in the country. It basically allows it. It gives permission to everybody else to be misogynist. What we do recognize is this is not a simple task. It's going to be huge. It would require complex responses, and we really think these should be evidence-based. We're very concerned with programs trying to address deeply embedded complex issues that are oversimplified and don't then have that desired effect and then waste the money that is spent. We would love to see that in partnership with civil society, but certainly led by government, and it will need time and resources. This is not a project that will be addressed in 5 years. Our main concerns in terms of the limitations of this bill have been addressed by many. The issue of where we think some of the tightest provisions in this bill are the ones that would affect women in formal employment, which has been noted. We do recognize, and I haven't listed them in my presentation, but they are in our submission on page 10. I could list, I think it was 7 or 8 clauses in this bill that touch on these very important issues of discrimination and equality and healthcare and education. But when you read those clauses, there's nothing really in them except to say that we must do something about it. So what's missing and what we recommend is clear targets, intervention plans, time frames, which was mentioned by one of the other presenters, strong monitoring and reporting. I'll talk a little bit to our assessment of that in the bill. And then most importantly, human and financial resources. And what we want to say about the limitations, most importantly, is that the vagueness of these provisions, the very weak enforcement provisions, which have been discussed previously, and this reference repeatedly to progressive realization, gives a signal when you read this bill that what is in it is aspirational, that the intent behind it isn't strong, that we want to see a difference, but we're not going to say yet how we're going to achieve that. And again, as I say, I know the how is difficult to answer, so I'm not suggesting that we expect government to just have the answer quickly. So we need more than a new law. As has been mentioned in the previous presentation, a comprehensive audit in terms of current policy. Again, we don't see this as a quick desktop survey. We don't see this as something that we get a consultant in for 3 months to do and then present to the department and present to the various committees. We need to look at the failures in implementation, most certainly look at budgets and spending on every single piece of legislation relating to women's lives. And then, most importantly, accountability. We know that we're failing on accountability over and over and over again. We do note clause 94C2, and I want to just pick up because I think in the responses you all hear, but 94C2 does this. That clause says that the department should do this. It's one of the things they could do within a range of things. I don't think this should be left to the departments. I think this should be led more centrally, preferably by either the Ministry of Women, Children, Persons with Disabilities or the Presidency. Monitoring and reporting, we like that the bill throughout requires reporting to the minister. We note questions that have been raised by this very committee about how the ministry would handle all of those reports. But we would like to see the bill stipulate reporting to legislatures, not only to these committees on women, children, and persons with disabilities, but also to the relevant committees, be it justice or health or education, specifically on women's empowerment and gender equality. So it shouldn't just be to this ministry, but to all ministries and to the various committees. Most importantly, we are vexed in all of us, I think Parliament as well as civil society, in how we monitor the implementation because we don't have information. Time and again, we look at annual reports of government and we can't figure out what we're reading. I look at annual reports over a 5-year period for a department, be it justice or police and so on, and I can't form a cohesive picture because each year things are reported on differently, that some things are out 1 year in another year. So we'd like to see leadership from the department in terms of what the different departments should be reporting on, and those should also be stipulated that they should be publicly reported by annual reports. Budgets go way beyond this bill. I've heard notes that the department has assured this committee in the briefing session that their budget can handle what is required, and I've heard also, not necessarily from the department, but that other departments should have budgets for the gender focal persons, and therefore the issue of resourcing is not in fact an issue. I would disagree completely. To achieve everything set out in all of those sections besides that of gender focal points, all the departments are going to need to have budgets around this. The education issues, the skills development and so forth, there are a number of things in this bill that will require resources, monitoring and reporting. It all requires money. So it's not just pertaining to the budget of this department. But in fact, if you're talking about women's lives, it spreads across every single department in this government. What we are also calling for is that there should be mandatory women's budgets across all departments, again, clearly reported on, ring-fenced money, so that we can see the spending. And I just want to say, if we want to make changes after 20 years in the lives of more than 50% of this population, we're going to have to spend money. That's the bottom line. Enforcement has been addressed, so I will leave it. Definitions issues has been addressed by previous speakers, I'll leave it. I want to say about education and training, Many departments have got training programs about law. They're weak, they're insipid, and they don't have the effect that they want. We have magistrates being trained on the Sexual Offences Act in 3-hour sessions. We have police being trained in 1-hour sessions. It is no surprise that there's no change. Again, departments have committed to this kind of training but aren't able to deliver. Once again, we think guidance in terms of how this kind of training should be delivered is necessary, again, from this lead department in respect of women's rights. And I've given some detail about what could be added. I wanted to say, in addition to training, and we see this failing over and over again, there's an over-reliance. When people talk about the implementation of law, we over-rely on the notion that training will fix it. If we do more training and more public education, we'll see implementation. That is not the case. It's got to be linked to accountability systems. They have to run through from local management through to national. I'm nearly finished. We recognize the value of the equal representation clauses, but echo our colleagues in the issue that they duplicate existing law and only relate to certain women. I'm on my last points. Gender mainstreaming and units. This is an area that we could see some impact if it works. We're concerned gender mainstreaming has been tried before. We're not sure that there's a lot in this bill that's very different. Clearly, the requirements of senior level appointments is something different and may have impact. The requirements that there be regulations about the nature of the people employed and their roles and responsibilities may have impact. I've left a number of dots because it then depends what the regulations say. In respect of this, the bill is also silent on issues of gender desks and mainstreaming at very local level. In municipalities, in police stations, in hospitals, that could be a point of interface between government and the public generally, rather than just having points of interface where NGOs can access and kind of big bodies, which is more at the national level. And then we want to note that there's a serious need for clarity in terms of the various roles and the framework on the national gender machinery. Sorry, I'm stumbling. Final slide. So, in conclusion, we support the efforts to date and efforts hopefully in the future to improve circumstances of women. We don't think this bill will do it in this form. We need recognition that this is going to take time. There's no quick fix for this. And it's going to take intelligence, evidence, and hearts. And finally, the point has been made. Our submission deals with it quite extensively. We note that the provincial hearings provide an opportunity for further consultation. The question will be how those are conducted, whether there's sufficient resources and time allocated to those hearings by the various legislatures to ensure that they reach broadly out, that it's in, as was mentioned, language, that other barriers to participation are addressed, childcare, for example. We're concerned about the dangers that are embedded in women speaking out against patriarchal systems, and that those systems of hearings need to provide for some protection to women against any backlashes that may occur as a result of their speaking out at those. And thank you. I'm sorry, I think I went over time. Apologize.
Thank you very much. Seated here, we are timing you. So if you go way, we will stop you. So thank you very much. Your points, I think, are all noted. And when I opened this morning, I did indicate that we are going to be having a day. The portfolio committee after this will be having, you know, hearing responses from the department. At this point in time, we are not going to. I think the department and the minister are here just to observe and listen to all the presentations. We are now going to break for tea for 30 minutes. The time is 2:15. Can we come back at 2:15? If we come before 2:15, I will really appreciate that. The first ones who will present after tea will be the Center for Applied Legal Studies. They are here, isn't it? Are they here?
Yes.
Okay. After two.